have sex with me?
At Skid Row Studios?
At Skid Row Studios.
Maybe. Okay.
Welcome to the Coon Round Report, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. This week, we will be talking about independent filmmaking with three members of the SAG short film, The Lesson. And also in our Gangs Are People 2 section with Lee Shaw, we'll be talking about the origins of the Crips. Right now we have on us with the phone, on the line, Judy Bowman. She is the co-producer of one of our upcoming veterans, upcoming section called the Veterans Corner. Judy is the development director for the Roby Theater Company. Judy, how you doing?
I'm good, Melvin. How are you?
Oh, just fine. Now, Judy, can you tell us about the project that you're working on? I know we're looking forward to your section on the Veterans Corner dealing with the book Bloods by Wallace Terry, but we talked about a couple other things today. Can you tell us a little about it?
Sure, Melvin, and I just wanted to thank you again for the opportunity to talk with you and Earlene and all your listeners. The project that we have in mind right now is to talk to activists and artists in Skid Row, and as we talk with them, train some volunteers to interview those people that have used art to make statements over the last 30, 40, however many years. The whole purpose of that is to show the art that's been done, show the ways that people in Skid Row have used art over these last several decades to make their statements wider known.
Okay. Hey, we're looking forward to that. I hope we have a chance to get into that soon. Also, can you touch a little on the section that you would be co-producing weekly on the show, the Veterans Corner?
Well, sure. I look forward to sharing the essays. There are 20 essays in the book that you mentioned by Wallace Terry. Those essays happened after several years of interviews. Wallace Terry was a black man. He was the first black man to be a foreign correspondent for a major TV network. He was or media person. He actually represented Time over in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And he got to meet these black men in all branches of the service, the Navy, Marines, Army, and Air Force. And he had hours and hours worth of tape when he came back and, whittled the tape down, transcribed the stories and whittled it down to these 20 essays that form a book that still in all tells a story, especially the story of a black man in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're looking forward to that. Now, for those who want to get in touch with you about being part of the Skid Row Artist Project, what's the information for?
Sure, anybody that would like to volunteer to work with us on that or to nominate an artist, could call 626-703-1230, 626-703-1230. Or they could email me. I'll say it and then I'll spell it. It's nomoretimetowrite@gmail.com. So it's nomotime, the number 2, and the word write, WRITE, at gmail.com. nomoretimetowrite@gmail.com.
Okay, Judy, we're looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to talking to you soon. And thank you very much for calling in. And, hey, we're looking forward to getting you in the studio so we can get this Veterans Corners rolling.
All right. All right. I look forward to that, too. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Judy.
Bye, Judy.
Bye. Bye.
Okay, Judy Bowman, she is the development director for the Roby Theater Company located in the downtown Los Angeles area at the Los Angeles Theater Center. Now, I am delighted to have with us in the studio three members of the production team of the SAG short film, The Lesson. The producer, Lydia Marion, the director and the writer, Chen Ni, and the assistant director, Andrew Chi. Lydia, Chen, and Andrew, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you so much for having us.
First of all, can you tell us a little about yourself and how did you get off into filmmaking? Let's start with you, Lydia.
Well, I started acting in 2000, and I always wanted to study, so I did two masters, one in the arts and one in sciences, and I focused on I wrote my thesis on generating revenue through mathematical-related intellectual property. So basically what I did is I looked at, in 2006, you have the Digital Millennium Act, which made it possible for people to patent math. So what's happening in the economy where people can patent math? And then as I did research, a lot of the math wasn't owned by the mathematicians. It was owned by other companies. So what's going to happen in a society where money is not given to the inventors of the intellectual property? And that's why we had intellectual property. So being an actor and having an interest in math, so when I came across this story, I was hooked.
Oh, and tell me again, what was your thesis, your doctoral thesis?
And my thesis for my master's was was generating revenue through mathematical-related intellectual property.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Beautiful. I see a book behind that. Okay, so, and how about you, Andrew?
For me, it started when I was a kid because I liked to write stories as a kid. I didn't get into film as a kid, but I wrote short stories and attempted novels. And as I grew up, I started learning how to draw and sketching and still art and photography. And then when I got older to around college area, I started finding about film, which is a combination of both writing and still photography and art. So I thought, because I like to tell stories by writing, maybe I could try it with film, which is more of a visual appeal, which has more of a visual appeal to it.
Mm-hmm. So you're looking towards a career in feature film?
Yeah, I'm hoping to do feature. I'm hoping to be able to keep the story, because independent short film has the ability to tell a story,
mm-hmm.
whereas feature tends to focus more on, you know, story, but also depending on this genre, action, comedy. But on an independent short film, you tend to really focus down on one type of main idea. I'm hoping in features I'm able to do the same thing and try to keep it to one main idea, but have it be a feature, so the story is much more complex and dynamic that you can.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about you, Tian?
Right now, I'm an MFA filmmaking student in NYFA, which is New York Film Academy. And I was majored in digital media art, which is more about post-production back in Beijing, China.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so about this story, this film is my year one film. So my father is a math professor in a university. So I want to maybe write something about him. So I came up with this story.
He's a prototype for this film. Is he exactly like this particular character?
Not really, but based on him.
Yeah, because I heard it was a great actor that's performing this particular role.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is a SAG short film?
Well, SAG is a Screen Actors Guild. So it was actually really wonderful to work with SAG. They, as a producer on this film, they basically give you regulations to work by. So making sure that, you know, the actors, you know, are fed at certain hours. So it's not really that hard to follow SAG guidelines. And even if you're not a SAG film, you know, it's good to look at the regulations, because basically it's like, teach the people you work with, you know, work with people and, you know, show some respect.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's basically, you know, if you follow all the regulations, that's basically what it boils down to, you know. Don't overwork the people and treat them with respect, you know, feed them. Mm-hmm. They're hungry, you know. So you can go online, and SAG works a lot with, like, low-budget films.
Mm-hmm.
And when you work with children, it gets harder, but we didn't in this particular case. We were thinking about it, but then we had to have a teacher, and we actually found some great actors mm-hmm. that were a little older to play younger, so that solved that for us.
Okay. Is it a major difference between the SAG for the feature films and then for the short film?
Well, financially it changes because if you're a big production, if you're a low-budget film, SAG SAG has a lot of things, and if you're a student film or a SAG short film, indie films, they pull a lot of plugs, so you can pay people in deferred pay, so that means you pay them after you sell the film. So now with this economy, SAG makes it possible for filmmakers that don't have that big of a budget to pay everybody up front to you know, get their film made and then sell it and then pay the people that worked
on
it.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. Okay, now tell us a little about the film, The Lesson. Can you tell us about the film?
Yeah, The Lesson is a period piece which takes place in World War II, China, and it's about a Chinese mathematician cannot cope with the reality of the war, and he finds his escape in his teaching.
Mm-hmm. And this was the prototype was your father, et cetera. Was any personal experience that your father went through some of that as a mathematician?
My father, well, he's very into his own math world. Yeah, so, yeah, but I'm not interested in math. But so I always wonder why he's so, you know, math is so attractive to him. Mm-hmm. So that's why I want to.
Well, what subject was he teaching?
He teaches in university, so I don't really know. I don't really know what he does.
Okay. Now, is this your first script? The first script? Have you written any early short scripts or anything?
No, it's pretty much the second big project I wrote.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, what is the plan for the lesson? Can you tell us what plan you guys have for?
Yeah, well, right now we just started the post-production phase, so that means we're going to edit. We started the editing process and then sound design. We have a wonderful composer that's actually playing in Ohio, I think. He's playing right now in two different states. He's really famous from playing these classical Chinese instruments. Mm-hmm. So it's really great that we have him on board, and he's actually already like thinking of working on the score. He sent him some samples, so that's great. So when we're done with the editing process, we can put his side in. But then concerning the film festivals, when we're done with the film, we'll try to submit it to as many film festivals as possible. But, you know, you have to be lucky to get selected.
Yes. Okay, now what is the impact of the Internet on independent filmmaking?
Well, I think since I grew up with the internet, pretty much, I've kind of seen it go from 56K slow to cable now. And the internet has made communication with people in general much, much easier. People who don't even know each other can communicate on websites or any other type of services on the internet. And anyone with common goals easily find each other. So someone puts up a website, say, for a short film. And then everyone who's interested goes to that site, and then they communicate. The community can talk to each other and pass ideas between everyone, and everyone kind of grows together. Whereas before, a community in one city, say New York, can only communicate really with other like minds in New York. They can't really communicate with China. They can't communicate with Russia, Europe, because the time zone difference, and there's no way to communicate with them by any other way besides phone. The internet now has allowed us to talk with people, email, or even in real time, other people in other countries, even in different languages to a certain extent. And that communication is able to bring, especially in these low-budget films, where it takes a bunch of people together to be able to fund a big project, and that's what helped us the most.
Mm-hmm.
And also for filmmakers out there, you know, basically you can reach your audience directly. So if you have a project that has a specific story that, you know, will appeal to other people, you know, without with Facebook and with all these different outlets out there, you can reach people that are interested in the same goal. And like, if you post something today, tomorrow you might have a crew of six people that are passionate about the same project. And next week you might be, you know, starting meetings and working on actually making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah, what you said, the communication is now so much easier. And with crowdfunding, you have Indiegogo, Kickstarter, and now they're popping up all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually start basically pre-selling your film. You know, you say like, okay, if you give us $10, we give you a digital download of our film. Mm-hmm. And if you have enough people wanting to put those $10 in, you know, you can actually start like paying some of the people that worked on the film.
Yeah, especially because it's a matter of cost when it comes down to the film. That, and you know, if you have one person funding $20 million, that's one person funding $20 million. You can get the same amount of money with 20 million people all funding $1. And when you have the communication services like the internet, it's very much easier to get in touch with other people with similar interests. And yes, $1, $10, you know, people are willing to submit that for to see a good film able to get off the ground. Whereas before, you know, finding $20 million from one person may not be exactly feasible for some, but now with the internet, it makes it so much more mm-hmm. possible.
Now, how about that aspect of, it's a lot of little web series that you see on the internet, you know, how about that?
Can the webisodes?
Yeah, can you comment on that?
Webisodes, well, I haven't personally made any of them. I watch several of them, and the appeal I can find out about is that it's much easier to produce. It's, you know, you make it in the studio or wherever, and then you don't have to distribute. You don't have to find a distributor. It's simply a matter of uploading it to YouTube or whichever mail, any other streaming site online, and it instantly now you can distribute to the entire world. Is anyone, any country with access to YouTube or any other media streaming site can now see whatever you want to show them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, you had to go through distribution companies, film distribution companies, and then you have to make it the physical DVD or film, depending on what your media is, which gets expensive, and then you have to send it to theaters to play it. Now everything's digital online,
mm-hmm.
and webisodes appeals to that.
Any possibilities like that for a piece like The Lesson?
Well, the problem is with The Lesson, it's a period piece. So we actually put a lot of, you know, time and effort in actually completely building the set from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some great people working with us. Eric, he put in a lot of effort to actually build the set, and he hardly had any time or materials to work with, but he did a wonderful job. So the thing is, for The Lesson, because we tried to make it as authentic as possible, for us it probably isn't cost effective to make a whole webisode out of it. But for filmmakers out there, if you have a good story and you want to test out if it works, you know, there's a large audience of YouTube watchers out there. If you get a lot of hits, you know, it's you got potential because you got an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make films and then people are not watching it or clicking on it, then, you know, it doesn't resonate. So the next one, you just change. And it's a good way to test out if your material resonates with your audience.
Yeah, and if you get lots of hits, you know, get a million, 2 million hits, you know, big companies notice that. And then that helps, you know, low-budget filmmakers like us, or even just small people who want to make webisodes, get noticed.
Mm-hmm. Now, with set construction, was that the largest part of the budget for The Lesson?
Yeah, the set budget was the largest we had, because that was basically the world, the story. Without the set, there's no world. So we had to make it look as authentic looking as possible, so we spent most of our effort there.
Mm-hmm.
The other effort was finding the right cast for it, make it believable that these people would exist
mm-hmm.
in this world.
You mean the budget financially?
Or? Yeah, yes.
So, yeah, what we did is basically we spread our resources as much as possible. So we tried to avoid putting too much upfront costs in, which we were able to do up to a point. But location is also, you know, major expense, materials. We had to get the costumes. So everything together, it wasn't that one thing was our main. It was just accumulation of all the different things to make it what it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the process. Let's talk about the step-by-step process where we can get some comments from it. Let's start with you just received the script of Lesson. Let's go by step-by-step, your process from the script, you know, like audition, table sessions, shooting, editing, all the way through.
First of all, we started pre-production, which like we read through the script. We went through every single thing we needed, you know, from casting to props, and worked on like what is our budget going to be for this. And throughout, we went through every single thing we needed. So that was kind of pre-production, making sure everything goes planned, finding the cheapest location, getting people to get, you know, love the story, and maybe giving us good deals. The Vortex actually gave us a really great deal. You know, they really liked the story, and mm-hmm. they were really nice, wanting to help us out to making this film possible.
Yeah, good shout out for Jeff Parker.
Yeah, it was wonderful, and yeah. they were all wonderful. So that's one part, and then when the production starts, you're probably best at starting on the production mm-hmm. from a day to day.
Yeah, well, as the assistant director, it's most of my job is in the production stage, but a lot of it also does come in the pre-production stage, since the three key figures, the director, the assistant director, and the director of photography, we basically sat down and we discussed the type of the director would tell us the story and the type of shots, the angles that she wants to use to capture the story. The director of photography would think about how he would light it, how to best express the mood for each shot. And then as the assistant director, I would be putting all of these in a list form, and then I would just see, do we have the time to shoot all these material in the allotted budget and everything. So combining budget, time allowed, you know, we can't work 24 hours a day for 5 days. So, you know, we have to plan all these things out. Otherwise, you know, you fall behind schedule, then quality may drop. So in the pre-production stage, I was there taking, you know, trying to time all the material together so that we can get all the shots in the time we are allowed. Then when production stage comes around, we already have all the plans set. So it's just a matter of executing the plan, and having, you know, having a good pre-production stage is definitely important. Mm-hmm. Without the proper plan going into production stage, you tend to make it up on the spot, and that costs time. It's better when everything is planned beforehand, so everyone knows what they're doing on the day of production.
Is that when the shooting script is developed also?
In the pre-production stage?
Yes.
The shooting script is usually solidified before. So the writer, in this case the director as well, Chen, she wrote the script, and then once she has the script done, she begins coming up with the shots that she wants to tell the story with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's go from that stage to what's next, the casting?
After...
Well, I mean, because I kind of took over part of the casting process, because, but we did it together.
So it was going on at the same time.
Yeah, because we had, like, even though 2-3 months looks like a lot of time, it was still a lot of, you know, work to make everything happen, just because it was a period piece, you know? We actually had costumes shipped in from China, because we couldn't find them as authentic over here. So, we did the casting process, but I've personally done martial arts for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so we asked around some martial arts trainers, because a lot of them are Asian, you know? So the mm-hmm. chances of them knowing some, you know, Mandarin-speaking actors. So even though we did a casting process through the normal way, putting it online, putting it on LA casting and all the websites, we actually end up finding, you know, some great people through, you know, thinking about, okay, who do you know? And if, you know, who do you know that will know people like this, you know? Mm-hmm. Because we had somebody in mind we wanted, and then just finding creative solutions to try and find that person.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about the great theater company, the East West Players, which is a theater company downtown? Some of your greatest actors, Asian actors. Did you touch base with the East West Players also?
We wrote to, I'm not sure if we wrote them directly, but we did contact, Luciana is another producer. She couldn't be here tonight. But she contacted a lot of Asian communities, and they forwarded out a lot of information to a lot of their members.
Mm-hmm.
But
How was the response?
Well, some people responded, but actually the greatest help was through Jack, right?
Yes, Jack Huang. He is the martial arts trainer in our school, and I asked him for help, and he's a friend of Raymond Ma, who is the actor, main actor.
Mm-hmm.
So
the lead actor.
Mm-hmm. The lead actor. Mm-hmm. And we gave him a phone call, and he said yes. Just mm-hmm. immediately.
Okay. Let's go to the next step. Okay, you've cast, et cetera, like that, all your pre-production work. Now you're ready for your first rehearsal, your first table session. What is that like? When it's the first time you get all of the cast members for the lesson together.
Well,
is this the first time you give them the script, or you give them the script when you cast?
Well, we sent people the script or parts of the script even before they came into audition. I always like, personally, because I'm an actor, I like people to come in knowing as much as they can about the part. Because I feel if people come into audition, you know, they're an actor, they're spending their time on coming to see you, I just want to give them enough background about the character so that they know what they're coming in for. So a lot of the other parts, like the Japanese soldiers and a lot of the other characters that did came in through LA casting and those, a lot of the people, they showed up knowing exactly, you know, what we wanted. And that's, you know, to avoid not wasting their time and our time. So they did know a lot about the story before they came in.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a few exceptions that weren't, but most people did.
Mm-hmm. And the first rehearsal, table session rehearsal, the first rehearsal, what's that like? I mean, first time you get to cast together.
I rehearsed with the lead actor once, only in Chinese, because the other two actors, they don't speak Chinese. So mm-hmm. So I rehearsed with him in Mandarin and go through the script, made some adjustment based on acting. And then we did the dressing rehearsal, right?
Yeah, so we had a couple of rehearsals, but to be honest, we worked more mainly with people personally, like you just said, mm-hmm. because this project is besides being a period piece, you know, everybody speaks Mandarin. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, I might know a few words, but so it was mainly the director actually working really close with the directors, and then making sure that the actors that don't speak Mandarin, that they know exactly what's going on, because, you know, they have to respond to the lesson.
Mm-hmm. Now, would it be subtext, subtitles?
Yes, there will be subtitled, and we had an English version of the script as well as a Chinese one.
Okay.
And we got a lot of people to work on the set that actually spoke Mandarin, speak Mandarin, so to make it just easier.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the first day of shooting. How is that? The first shooting day.
The very first day of shooting. Well, it was, the first day is usually the most chaotic. I try to make it as less chaotic as possible. You know, it's first day. No one really knows where the location is, though there's a map and everything. And it's as easy as possible, but people still somehow get lost, even with GPS. But, yeah, the first day was... You know, we had parking set up, we had the studio location set, and everyone showed up, and when everyone showed up, we entered the studio. I basically had to start getting everyone going, because as assistant director, if I don't say anything, no one does anything. They just sit around and eat breakfast all day. So the first day was, you know, food was laid out, but first thing was we loaded all the equipment into the studio. So we had the equipment trucks and the art truck as well with the set already there, and I had to coordinate two teams, one to move the set in and one to bring the equipment in. And then when they're in, they'd have to put all the equipment in one area. They start building the set immediately. And those that aren't as needed. So perhaps like if you've loaded the equipment, they can grab a little bagel, some orange juice, and then come back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, how many shooting days did you have for that?
We had
six.
Six shooting days. Okay, now you just finished the product. You got it in the can. Let's talk about the editing process. Can we talk about that for a while?
Editing, no. I'm doing the rough cut. So after the rough cut, I'll lock down the cut, like the final cut. And then we'll add visual effects and then sound effects and music.
And graphics, all of that.
Graphics.
Titles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Subtitles. And music. And then, yeah, that's it.
Where are we at in the process now? You know, how long you think it would take before the lesson is out there?
I'll say 1.5 months.
Okay.
Yeah. And also, because it's a period piece, you know, we shot for like 6 days, but the thing is you have to realize that for like 2 weeks before that, or like one full week, you know, day in, day out, people are actually building the set. So for us, it feels like longer than just 6 days. For the actors, it was just a few days working on set. But, you know, for us working on it for a couple of months beforehand, you know, it wasn't just the 6 days of shooting. It was just, you know, mm-hmm. the thing we were planned for. And now with the post-production, you know. So the shooting days, you know, is the shooting days. But the mm-hmm. amount of work, even though the first day of shooting actually went pretty smoothly, like you got everything in the can mainly. But it was also, it's the first day you learn to work with people you haven't worked with. And so it's basically the most exciting day because you get to learn so many new people and faces. And
mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we'll come back with our Gangs of People section, and also we'll be coming back for some closing comments and thoughts.
This is the community calendar for July. Every Tuesday from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m.,
you are listening to Skid Row
Melvin Studios. Ishmael Johnson is teaching a veterans community workshop. The class is limited to 15 participants. If you're interested, please contact him as soon as possible. He's currently working on a stage play, Surviving the Nickel, and the workshop participants will be performing this play on August the 26th, and we'll have more information on the upcoming performance. The workshop location is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard. This is at the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. And if you're traveling by the Metro bus, take the number 60 and number 66, and it stops right at the corner. For more information, you can give a call at 323-850-4436. Also, Sunday, July 22nd at 3 p.m., Drumstage Qumran is presenting the musical performance of Art Walk Jamal. He plays the Memphis and Chicago style blues, and he's a resident of our community. The location of the exchange is 114 West 5th Street, Los Angeles. Parking is available at Joe's Auto Park, 530 South Spring Street. For more information on this event, you can call 323-850-4436. This is a free event, and all are welcome to attend. And if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, just send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And once again, our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Thank you, Earlene Anthony. We're back with the Qumran Report. Today in our Gangs Are People 2 section, we're going to talk about the origins of the Crips with Lee Shaw, one of the co-producers of this segment. He's an actor and community activist and also the stage manager for Drama Stage Qumran. Lee, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you for having me.
Lee, I'd like to read from the Wikipedia about the origins of the Crips. It says, The Crips are primary but not exclusively an African-American gang. They were founded in Los Angeles, California in 1969, mainly by Raymond Washington and Stanley Williams. What was once a single alliance between two autonomous gangs is now a loosely connected network of individual sets, often engaged in open warfare with one another. The Crips are one of the largest and most violent associations of street gangs in the United States, with an estimated 30,000 to 35,000 members. The gang is known to be involved in murders, robberies, and drug dealing, among other criminal pursuits. The gang is known for its gang members' use of the color blue in their clothing. However, this practice has been weighing down due to police crackdown on gang members. Crips are publicly known to have an intense and bitter rivalry with the Bloods and lesser feuds with some Chicano gangs. Crips have been documented in the U.S. military, found in bases also in the United States and abroad. Stanley Tukey Williams met Raymond Lee Washington in 1969, and the two decided to unite their local gang members from the west and east side of South Central Los Angeles in order to battle neighboring street gangs. Most of the members were 17 years old. Williams discounted the sometimes cited founding date of 1969 in his memoirs, Blue Rage, Black Redemption. Lee, can you comment on that?
Yeah. My first introduction, as far as knowing who they were, was in 1971. I was raised up on the east side, so I really didn't get to meet Tukey until 1979. But there was another person in his book, Blue Rage, Black Redemption, that he referred to as Black Johnny. Well, I didn't know him as Black Johnny. He had, the initials were right, but it was a different name. And I won't even go into that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What made it real bad for him is that, and I don't believe that would have even been a Blood. You know what I'm saying? If it hadn't been for one thing that they did that they was doing that was actually, that put an offensive thing up with the other group, and that was robbery. You know, back then there wasn't a lot of money, but they was like just taking things from people. You know what I'm saying? This is what it all amounted to. It was just taking leather coats, taking a little money you had. And this Black Johnny, he used to go up to Jefferson High School, and they actually shoot the school up. You know what I'm saying? And the brothers that was in that area got tired of that right there, getting shot at, chased down, you know? So they brought a rival thing in, right? But it didn't go by the Bloods, but it was AC Deucey and other little things. And that started it right there. Mm-hmm. It started from that particular point, and it just rose.
Mm-hmm. You know? Now, can you discuss the economic condition and violence where gangs reside, you know, the relationship between the economic conditions and the community?
Because of the high rate of violence, and I say hoods, right, because there's many of them. Like you say, sets. You know, you talking about one hood right across the street from another, you know, so I just use the word hoods. And that, because of the violence, the manufacturing and developers are afraid to come here. You know, we can look at one of the biggest retail giants, Walmart. They're not even crazy enough to go down there because it wouldn't make sense. You know, I would hate to close my store at 12 o'clock at night and come back at 6 to open it up and ain't nothing in it.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, and because of that right there, it causes that there's no economic growth. And that causes a high rate of violence and crime
and
drug sales.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because people are going to do whatever it takes to survive. And that's one of the key things. In the hoods, people are not living. They are surviving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all they're doing. They're surviving. Mm-hmm. It's like just like being in a little spot with five cookies laying down there, and we all is millions of ants, and we all want to get to survive.
Same cookie.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so they don't, you know, there's some things that could be done to change that, you know, but are the people willing to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a paradox and a relationship between the economic conditions in the community and the amount of violence, drugs, et cetera, because of the fear of companies and business coming into the community to set up and provide jobs, et cetera, like that. Okay. Now, what can we do about this? Just for a minute, talk about that. What can we do to, do we start with the economic conditions, like something that they had in the 80s when they came up with the CEDA program to train youngsters or something to create jobs?
If I was going to orchestrate something, I would have to deal with their mind first. For the first thing, and I believe this to be true, and people do it and they don't realize they'd be doing it. I don't use the word neighborhood and community in the same sentence because they're not the same things, right? So what I would have to do is to convince these people to stop with this neighborhood thing and become a community. Mm-hmm. And make each one, not change the name of where they had, what they had before. Don't change your name, but make you responsible for what goes on in that little small community of yours. Mm-hmm. And make you and make the community raise it up.
Mm-hmm. So what's the major difference that you see between a community and a neighborhood? Well, hood, that they call.
Okay. Shortly. This is short. We take the words apart, right? Nay is something that causes uncomfortable. It makes you uncomfortable. It's when you hear that horse going, that old funny sound he makes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the boring type thing. It's constant, right? And a hood is something that covers something. You know, when they used to do the electric chair, they put a hood on a man's face so you wouldn't see the hideousness of the shock, mm-hmm. right? So you were closed into a little old hood, right?
Mm-hmm.
And your neighbor or one next to you, you would barely come. You would rarely come outside. You know what? I remember.
Don't know who the neighbor is.
Yeah, you may not even know his name, right? You come outside to go to work in the morning. You say, "Hey," you get in your car and you leave. You come back here, "Hey." You know, there's no interaction between you,
mm-hmm.
right? But in the community, there's interaction because we are going root word, common, to commune, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is community.
And
so
similar,
we are a whole community. We are striving for the same things,
mm-hmm.
right?
Similar vested interests.
Mm-hmm. See, so you have to deal with that first.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you deal with the major, that's the major problem right there. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It can, because if I can make a community, if we can start a community, then we can raise the community, right? We can set a standard for this right here where the children will follow the same standard and push it up,
mm-hmm.
right? Then people will come in. Because if I had 12 square blocks of L.A. and made it a community, I almost guarantee you I can get the stores I need in there.
Mm-hmm. People come in, provide the job.
You know?
Okay, thank you, Lee. Now, next week, we will continue our discussion about the economic relationship to violence in our community. So thank you, Lee. Now, okay, let's get some closing comments from our guests. Can you tell the audience about where they can expect or when to see the short film, The Lesson?
Well, right now you can go to, we have a Facebook fan page. It's The Lesson, The Short, because it's a short film. We also still have our casting email that's open. It's thelessoncasting@gmail.com. So if you want to contact us directly, you can still contact us through there. But we have a Facebook fan page, so everything will be updated on mm-hmm. there.
Wonderful. Okay, now Lydia, can you tell us about some of your upcoming projects? And I hear that you're playing the role of Conrad in Shakespeare's play Much to Do About Nothing. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, I'm rehearsing for it. We'll be rehearsing for the next 6 weeks, and then it opens at the Knightsbridge Theater, mm-hmm. which is very close to where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Riverside Drive and the 5.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Andrew? What projects you got coming up?
Well, I have my thesis project coming up for my master's program in film, and you know, I have a goal for it. I'm trying to. Well, I have my favorite films and movies always are worlds that are slightly different than now. So you can see a guy walking down the street and suddenly he just jumps 20 feet in the air. You know, it's, it seems like our normal world, but a little bit different. So
like science fiction?
Yeah, science fiction fantasy, though. Like, it's a similar world to ours. I grew up reading Star Wars. I grew up reading Dragonlance. And then I explored more books like Game of Thrones and Song of Fire and Ice, you know. Just different kinds of books. And I like going into other worlds. When I read or want to watch movies, it's, you know, it's an escapism tool also, but it's also fun. It's fun to go into these other worlds. Not saying that, you know, these worlds don't exist now. Maybe they do, some concept. But, you know, otherwise, the only way I can really experience them is in books and in movies. And I want other people to experience that same fascination I have with other, with fun worlds. So I'm hoping that the feature I'm coming up to right now is hopefully... we'll get that across. People will hopefully enjoy the world I create.
Mm-hmm. And your thesis, what, it's going to be on dealing with what? Your thesis?
The subject matter of it?
Yeah.
Not exactly sure yet. Still in the writing process.
Okay.
We have another year to write it, so.
Yeah, looks interesting. GM, how about you with future projects?
I'll shoot my thesis about next year, too. So, yeah, I'll try to make a feature, too. Mm-hmm. And I'm still coming up with a script too now.
Mm-hmm. Do you plan to write most of your own films?
Yeah, I'll try to.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll definitely try to write mine as well, since mm-hmm. I like writing my world. No one else really knows my mind but me.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the major challenges of being an independent filmmaker, especially a young independent filmmaker.
I'm
shooting, I'm working as an actor for a feature film actually right now. That's Chances. And I was talking with my mom the other day because you read in the tabloids like how great it is to be an actor and you get your own trailer and all that sort of stuff. And every time my mom reads it, she basically falls off her chair laughing. Because when she hears my stories, you know, one day I'm sleeping in this trailer that, you know, looks like the floor could fall out, maybe, you know, depending on which shoot it is or what, you know, last few shoots I got lucky. But, you know, sometimes you sleep with your hair next to a door and your hair gets slammed in between the door and somebody pulls it, you know. So it's filmmaking is really funny, but basically it's like, we have a passion for storytelling, and storytelling is the oldest profession on this planet. You know, we've been doing it for tens and tens of thousands of years, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's a way to communicate. And the internet has made it possible now to communicate, you know, over large distances. And it's just an amazing, amazing process. So whether you love documentary films or you want to create your own world with a feature film or a short animation project, there's so much opportunity out there because the cost of cameras is getting lower and you can distribute online and, you know, there's all these opportunities. So basically we can all be our new Charlie Chaplin starting our own, you know, web series if, mm-hmm. if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about some more of the major challenges that you find being a young filmmaker?
As a young filmmaker? I would say there's challenges because it's you're young and you're not as experienced, but I find the advantage of being young is you have much more, well, your mind is much more open to be able to tell as many stories as you feel to fit. Your mind is not really set in stone. And I kind of hope my mind never gets set in stone.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I don't follow a trend or I don't create one success and then be forced to do that same success 4 or 5, 6 times over.
Mm-hmm.
And also probably the challenges is, I mean, filmmaking is a very unique industry and a lot of it revolves around, it is an entertainment business as well. It's all about getting people to experience your world just as much as you experience it. And, you know, I hope that it doesn't, the challenges of particularly finance, since it does sometimes come down to money in the end. And I'm hoping that those things don't ever block the creative process. And that's mm-hmm. one thing I'm glad about, how technology is making more accessible to young filmmakers now. Cameras are cheaper, equipment is cheaper, you know, distribution is more readily available, like the internet. So now everyone has a story to tell, and that creativeness is no longer blocked by equipment or money. Mm-hmm. Now it's more, you know, readily available to everyone.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Jen? Some of the major challenges being a young filmmaker, especially a writer and director?
For me, it's just to have great people on board, because sometimes you will meet some unreliable people. And this time I was very lucky to have many talented people work with me, but still, like, budget wise and crew wise, that's mm-hmm. what I'm, yeah.
Now, for a director, do you have to have a good eye for sight lines and all of that kind of stuff, or being able to create on the spot something that you see?
Can you rephrase the question?
Being a good director, you have to have a good sight line, good eye, like someone, like a good cameraman that takes a, feeling for that?
Definitely come up with stuff on the spot. I mean, you have a script and everything is set, but it doesn't mean that you have to follow it, you know, specifically. Yeah. Creativeness is not set in stone. It just kind of happens, and you have a plan beforehand, but, you know, if something catches your eye or you have a brilliant idea on the spot, just change it and do it. Mm-hmm. It's one of the brilliant things about filmmaking.
Shanna's a great vision. You know, many times on set, she's like, no, I don't like it. It has to be changed. So she knows exactly what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you know a specific example, if you saw something that happened on the set that you were like, you know, keep this in, or...
It's more about how it's more about light. That because my the DP he really like to make everything dark, but sometimes it doesn't fit the scene or the theme that I try to tell. So we had some argument about the light, the lighting,
yeah. Which of course was all in Mandarin.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was one of the last shots that I think you were actually a witness of that one. It was a dolly shot that was in a circular dolly and that had a really complicated pan. And I think, you know, your vision was really important in making that scene happen. And I don't know if you want to say something about that particular shot in the church.
In the church, yeah. In the church, it's because we had we don't have too many extras, too many background actors. So about that shot, we try to make because it's the fantasy scene. So the teacher is in his fantasy. He's teaching in a lecture hall and with a lot of people, hundreds of students. There, but we only got
26, I
yeah,
think.
About 30 people, so we have to cheat. We have to cheat the camera.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now how about, we've talked about features and small, how about the approach to the small screen, television, anything like that? Do you see...
television series?
Yeah, television series or breaking into that, tying into that market also?
I think it's definitely some area of thinking. I mean, lately I feel the trend of filmmaking and movies in general is starting to lean towards TV series. You have a lot more. It's not that it's filmmaking or movies are bad. Everyone still loves going to theaters and watching a movie. I still love going to a theater and sitting down watching a movie. But with TV now, especially like series like maybe Breaking Bad or even those long series like Lost, they will be able to tell a story. Is you have a lot more time to do it in a TV series than a filmmaking movie. Movie, you have about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes ideally to tell a story, and then that's it, unless you want to make a sequel. But in a TV series, you have an hour per episode, and the ability to tell a story in a TV series is just much more free. You have a lot more room to do it, and that's probably why we're starting to see more and more creative stories come out of television. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot in movies, but that the TV television episodes are much easier to produce and create than...
And then the avenue of cable TV also to create opportunity?
Well, I know, like, in the different channels, like in Europe, they sometimes actually have, like, special sections for independent films, which is great. But, you know, like, television programs and pilots, you know, people actually are now... Some people that work on our production, Hidetoshi, is actually shooting a web series that he's trying to pitch as a pilot. So a lot of people right now are shooting web series and then turning that into pilots that they sell, that they're trying to pitch. Because if they get enough traffic and enough people to click on their channel, you know, that shows that the audience is willing to spend their time watching it. And so, you know, if you do want to do independent television, I know that there are a few projects that are being shot that's independent television, but they're really high budget still. Mm-hmm. And they're mainly shooting in Europe, and they're flying part of the cast over. And different countries have different incentives. So if you have a production, but these budgets are, you know, like up there. So, you know, and then depending on the country you go, you know, some countries, they give you 25% back if you hire local people. So, you know, if you invest enough in a film, that's why some of the productions are leaving Los Angeles or California, because, you know, like, they're shooting a lot of movies in Iceland right now. And, you know, why is that? You know, because there are a lot of incentives. So, and the same is, like, you know, finding a location. You know, you're probably going to shoot where whoever gives you the cheapest
deal.
You know, and now it's just not, you know, the neighborhood anymore. It's what, or a community. It's what country? Mm-hmm. What country gives you the best deal? And that's where you're going to shoot. So whether it's the Bahamas, Iceland, or, you know, LA, it boils down to money.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Lydia, Andrew, Tien. I would like to extend a special thank to our in-studio guests, Lydia Marion, Chin Ni, Andrew Chi, Lee Shaw, and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Please check out our past show of the Coomeram Reports on iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, skidrow.la, and dramastage-coomeram.org. Thank you for tuning in to the Coomeram Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great job. Cool. Good. We're going to take...